You're listening to Clinical Conversations, back after a long hiatus for a new round of talks with people shaping the future of clinical medicine. I'm Joe Elia. This week we begin a series on the lessons from the bombings at the Boston Marathon back on April 15th. We have as our first guest Dr. Ron Walls, professor and chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School, which received about 30 casualties on that day. Welcome, Dr. Walls.
Thank you, Joe.
While preparing for this chat, I read your recent Viewpoint piece in JAMA, the one you wrote with Michael Zinner, and I'll put a link to it in the Clinical Conversations webpage. And I know that you've drilled for these emergencies, and your JAMA piece indicates that Brigham and Women's is pretty relentless about those drills. But even given that preparation, what managed to surprise you about this event?
I think despite the amount of preparation that we had done and the fact that we were pretty well drilled for almost any kind of mass casualty event, and we had specifically drilled for a mass casualty event that involved a bomb in the city of Boston, it was the suddenness of it. It was the fact that at 1 minute I was sitting in my office with my administrator doing my budget, and then just a few minutes later, it was this complete transformation, and I had said this before, but as if someone had just flipped a switch, mm-hmm. and life had just changed at that moment.
It's like being ambushed, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a different concept to be prepared, mm-hmm. and to be ready.
Yeah.
Ready means you're standing there waiting. We're ready when we get notification of a trauma. We get 7 minutes out, 3 minutes out, even 1 minute out. We're ready. When they come in, we're always prepared, but we're sometimes ready as well. And on this day, we were prepared because we're prepared every day. And we were ready, but we were ready for typical marathon stuff, which is lots of runners with dehydration or hyponatremia or fatigue or all of the things that happen to runners. But having this happen was a bolt out of the blue.
Yeah. As I was reading about all those drills, I realized that emergency departments can easily disrupt current emergencies to drill for future ones. So how do you guys manage to do that?
So the big thing that is different in a mass casualty event than in your regular day-to-day operation is not the type of injury or the type of patient or the complexity of it, it is the sheer numbers. And when we drill, we have two primary components to the drill. The first is to create capacity, meaning to create the space in the emergency department, the beds and the providers that you need to deal with a large number of critical patients at once. Mm-hmm. And then the second part is to exercise that capacity properly to execute on the care of the patients with these teams that you have deployed to these different areas or beds or bays that you have set up so that each one of them can work as if they are doing their normal thing, a small team of providers, highly trained, working harmoniously on one patient. And so the actual care that's delivered in that moment at that bedside of that critical patient, if you've done your job right, that care is just like it is every day. It's only when you add it all together that the enormity of the event becomes obvious.
Is there an account either of this emergency or another one that you think clinicians would find useful? I'm thinking back that, you know, the last event of this magnitude in Boston was probably the Coconut Grove fire in the 1940s.
Yes, and when you think back to that, I mean, we can't think back to that because right. we weren't around then, but when you think back to what that was, that was an event that occurred in a city with a completely different type of pre-hospital care, meaning essentially no pre-hospital care at all, mm-hmm. Very different medical centers with no emergency physicians, no emergency medicine existed then really, and trainees working in largely unsupervised roles, much less involvement of attending physicians. It was a very different system with a very different capacity, but separately from that, it was a conflagration of a whole different scale.
Yeah.
With so many people just dying right on the scene.
Yeah. So are there things that you have been find yourself reading or listening to in the days after the bombings?
In the immediate aftermath of the bombing on Monday night, when we realized we had crested over the top and everybody was stabilized and many were in the OR and in the ICUs and some were still in the emergency department, but everybody was out of that immediate danger, our attention really turned first to the staff, mm-hmm. To think about what we needed to do for our staff who, you know, who are also traumatized by these things. It's obviously not remotely the kind of impact that the victims and their families feel, or even necessarily the people at the site who are not medically trained people who see things they never expected to see. It's not on that scale, but there is an important human side to these highly trained medical providers, that they are highly trained, they are medical providers, but they're people too.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are in home environments where their husband or wife or spouse is not medical. They don't feel they can really talk about any of this. They feel like it's an invasion of somebody's privacy to talk about it. They're deeply disturbed by it, and they're afraid to talk about it because they don't want to seem like they are disturbed by it because we're supposed to be so strong. And so on Monday night, I reached out to my colleague, Richard Zane, who was my former vice chair, who went to the University of Colorado last year about this time and was there for Aurora. And I contacted him, and I said, Rich, what did you do wrong? What did you do most wrong in the first couple of days after this, after that event? And he said, although we reached out to our staff and did a lot of staff support, we didn't do nearly enough. We underestimated the power of this and its ability to disrupt our staff. And so we started that night doing what we call a hot wash, which is a rapid debriefing where you gather as many of the providers as you can in one room, and people just talk about their experiences, what they saw, what they did, what bothered them, what they felt good about. And we did that first Monday night, and we did multiple scheduled debriefings for our resident group, our nursing group, our PA group, for all staff together. We scheduled additional debriefing sessions, and we arranged for professional counselors to reach out to every single person who was in our department that day, one-on-one, and reach them by telephone and encourage them to talk and offer them services and things. And that's the immediate next step after you stabilize the casualties. Next step after that, which starts almost the very next day, is you start the analysis, look at everything you did, exactly how it happened, timelines and responses, and figure out how to get better.
Do you think that the experience has changed or will change your leadership style?
No, I don't think it will. I think everybody felt proud that day that they were able to rise to this enormous challenge. It was an enormous challenge. I think it was empowering in a way, and I think it is helping people heal to know that they did such a good job. But our management style here has always been to empower and resource individuals to do what they do best in the best possible way and support them in that. And I think on that particular day, that was really tested and proven to be a good way, and we're going to keep on with that.
Good. Well, one final question, Dr. Walls. What is the one thing, and now you reached out to Rich Zane, what is the one thing that you would urge clinicians and other emergency departments to do this week that they may not have been doing last week?
Get prepared. As I said, I can't tell you to get ready because you can't stay at that state of readiness all the time, mm-hmm. and this is a very unlikely event. When you drill, you can make mistakes and learn from the mistakes, and you can drill again. But when this happens, when the real thing happens, and you are there and you have to respond, you've got to get it right. And the only way you'll get it right is if you've done it a lot before those patients come in. So I would encourage people who think that disaster preparedness is a technique or a checklist for the Joint Commission to think about it more seriously, and I'd encourage those who think about it seriously to think about it very seriously and to ask themselves and ask their hospitals, their facilities, and their teams, are we ready? Are we ready for what we need to be ready for? are we prepared to deal with? And then you can define what you think you might have to deal with, but really get ready for it.
All right. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Walls, for spending time with us today.
Joe, it was great to talk to you. Thank you.
That was our 160th edition, and all earlier editions may be found at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from Journal Watch. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Thank you for listening.